Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Paul Clark, a member of the club's International Relations Forum and your chair for today's program. We will also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Professor Larry Diamond, who will speak to us about the spirit of democracy. Larry Diamond is one of the world's leading experts on democracy and the process of democratization. Among a host of other honors and accomplishments, he's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institute, co-editor of the excellent Journal of Democracy, and a coordinator of the Democracy Program at the Center on Democracy, Development, and the Rule of Law at Stanford University. In early 2004, Professor Diamond served as an advisor to the Coalition Provisional Authority in Baghdad, the CPA. From his experience there, he wrote the book Squandered Victory, a very well-received recounting of the troubled attempt to impose democracy on post-Saddam Iraq. Professor Diamond is not a stranger to the Commonwealth Club podium, and he's returning today to speak to his new book, The Spirit of Democracy, The Struggle to Build Free Societies Throughout the World. Without any further ado, please welcome Dr. Diamond.
Okay, I'm glad you stopped, or I would have had to use this. I would like to thank Dr. Paul Clark for his very warm introduction, and I'd like to thank the Commonwealth Club for hosting me again. It's a pleasure to come back and to come back to talk to you about my new book, which is The Spirit of Democracy. I basically have three general arguments or themes of the book, and I'd like to spend some time talking about each one. My first theme, I think, is well known to most of you who've been following world affairs in the last 25, 30 years, that there has been a remarkable boom of democracy and spread of freedom around the world. But more recently, we have a newer phenomenon and a dangerous and disturbing one, which has been what I call, and the columnist Thomas Friedman reflected on it today in his column for the New York Times, a global democratic recession. I think that this is a serious threat to freedom in the world. It certainly is a grave threat to people who are victims of it in Zimbabwe, Tibet, Belarus, Russia, Venezuela, and other places in the world that I will discuss. And I'd like to reflect on the extent of this recession, some of the causes of it, and then talk about what I think needs to be done, what can be done to renew democratic progress. I'd like to just say by way of preface that this book, which was just published about 3 months ago, began with a lecture I gave at UC Irvine, ironically, literally around the time the U.S. was going to war in Iraq in March of 2003. It was a pure coincidence. The lecture had been scheduled for months in advance. And there I addressed the question, can the whole world become democratic? And based on my analysis of global trends and public opinion data, I argued in that lecture that the whole world can become democratic and had a good chance of becoming democratic over the coming decades. I still believe that and will offer some reasons as to why, but we now face, I think, more of the realities of how difficult it will be and how much more difficult it has become because of some of the mistakes, and I think there's no other word for it, imperial overstretch that have been associated with and committed by the administration of George W. Bush. With that, let me come now to a brief summary of some of the data I have in this book. To begin, you can see that the world has been transformed in the last 30 years, that when this so-called third wave of global democratization began in 1974 with the revolution that toppled the long-standing sort of quasi-fascist dictatorship in Portugal, only about a quarter of all the independent states in the world were democracies. And by democracy, I mean here simply a system of government in which the people can choose their leaders and replace their leaders in relatively free and fair elections that may coexist with high levels of freedom and a strong rule of law, or it may not. The wave of democracy began in Western Europe with transitions to democracy in Spain, Portugal, and Greece, then spread to Latin America, and then to East Asia, and then the collapse of the Berlin Wall brought it to not only the post-communist states, but to sub-Saharan Africa as well. And the percentage of democracies in the world gradually increased to about a third in the early 1980s, to nearly half of all the independent states in the world by the time that the Berlin Wall fell in 1989. By the time the Soviet Union was coming apart in 1991, about half of all the independent states in the world were democracies. There were 91 democracies in the world, and then there was a further explosion. First of all, in the number of states in the world, with the breakup of the former Soviet Union and the former Yugoslavia, and second of all, there was a still dramatic increase in the number of democracies. This leveled off in the mid-1990s. By then, there were 117 or so democracies in the world. That was three of every five states in the world, and that is where we've remained. Over the last 12 years, we have reached a kind of equilibrium in which the number of democracies in the world has oscillated between about 115 and 120, depending on how you count. I am mainly, not exclusively, but mainly relying for my count here on the annual assessments of Freedom House, the organization in New York that assesses which countries in the world are electoral democracies and levels of freedom in the world of all the countries in the world every year. And this has oscillated between about 60 and 62 or 63% of all the independent states in the world. So that's, on the one hand, very inspiring. On the other hand, I do ask you to take note of the fact that there has been this leveling off of overall democratic progress. On the hopeful side, we've seen quite a large number of countries make transitions to democracy. In all, in the last 33 years, about 97 countries, which is about half of the total of 196 countries that have existed in this period, have made transitions to democracy. And this is broken down in the following ways. First of all, 64 of the existing authoritarian states in 1974 have become democracies. There were 110 dictatorships and 40 democracies when this wave of democratization began in 1974. So almost three in every five of the authoritarian regimes in 1974 have become democracies. Then if you take all the states that have emerged during this period as a result of decolonization, mainly in the Caribbean, the Pacific Ocean region, and in some parts of sub-Saharan Africa, of those 27 new post-colonial states, a little over three quarters, 21 of them, have become electoral democracies. And of the 20 new post-communist states that were created by the breakup of Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, and the former Soviet Union, 12 of those 20 new states have become democracies. And so you can see here that there's been a great expansion of democracy, and relatively few countries, only 60 of all the states that have existed during this period, have remained continuously authoritarian with no experience with democracy at all. That's really quite remarkable when you think about it, that over this 33-year period, only 60 states have had no experience with electoral democracy at all. During this period, democracy has become, for the first time in world history, a global phenomenon. So you have now most of the Western Hemisphere, 31 of the 33 states of Latin America and the Caribbean are electoral democracies today, and many of them are fairly liberal ones, as I'll explain shortly. When you count all the post-communist states, including both Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, almost two-thirds of them are democracies, 18 of 28. By the end of 2007, there were only 8 of 25 states in Asia that were democracies, but now we see more democratic progress in Pakistan, where there's been an election that was reasonably democratic, but still the military has, I'd say, undemocratic control over the political system at the highest level. Bangladesh is scheduled to hold democratic elections this year. Nepal has just had elections for constituent assembly, and as many of you know, that very obscure former absolute monarchy until very recently of Bhutan has just held an election to become a democracy. So Asia has a thinner presence of democracy than it once had, and one hopes that it will have again, but it's moving back in a positive direction. If you take sub-Saharan Africa with 48 states, almost half of the independent states of sub-Saharan Africa, by my judgment, 23 of 48 are now at least electoral democracies. So this leaves, as you can surmise, one region of the world where democracy is scarcely present, and that's the Middle East. There are only two democracies in the Middle East today, Turkey and Israel. And none of the Arab countries of the Middle East can be said to be even electoral democracies. Lebanon comes closest, but when you're still living in the shadow of a terroristic regime that's vetoing, you know, who can ascend to the presidency of your country, namely I'm talking about Syria here, you can't say that the people are really sovereign. If the people aren't sovereign, then they don't have a democracy. Now, we can also, as you see here, measure not only levels of democracy in the world, but levels of freedom, which can assist us in measuring levels of liberal democracy. And fortunately, we have the very extensive data of this independent organization in New York, Freedom House, that measures every year levels of political rights and civil liberties. Freedom House does so on two scales of political rights and civil liberties with a very systematic methodology that they make available for public inspection on their website, www.freedom.org. www.freedomhouse, all one word, .org. And if you then click on Freedom in the World, you can see all of the data and all of their methodology. Each country in the world is rated each year from 1 to 7 on political rights and 1 to 7 on civil liberties. 1 is most free, 7 is most repressive. So I take here as an indicator of a liberal democracy with reasonably good protection for human rights, the rule of law, civilian control of the military, popular sovereignty in a deeper sense, those countries that get a 1 or a 2 on political rights and a 1 or a 2 on civil liberties that are in the top two categories on each scale. By that standard, all of the 28 states of Western Europe, North America, Australia, New Zealand are liberal democracies. And as you can see, a surprising proportion of the 33 states of Latin America and the Caribbean, slightly over half. About two in every five post-communist states, but there's a big divide there. Most of post-communist Europe, Central and Eastern Europe, is now not only democratic, but fairly liberally democratic. All of the 10 countries of the post-communist world that have been admitted by now into the European Union are liberal democracies, more or less, because they had to meet that standard in order to be admitted into the European Union. Very few of the post-Soviet states, other than the Baltic states, which are Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, which are members of the European Union. In Asia, we have four liberal democracies, Taiwan, Korea, Japan, and a fourth one that probably no one in this room will guess, Mongolia. Very good. And quite a large number of the Pacific Island states are liberal democracies. A few African countries like Botswana, South Africa, Mauritius, and Ghana, and virtually none except for Israel in the Middle East. We can, using the data of Freedom House, look at trends in terms of freedom in the world between 1974 and 2006. And you can see here that as the bars come down toward one, that means freedom is improving, since one is the freest score, averaging the two scales of political rights and civil liberties. Freedom, as viewed in this way, has improved quite dramatically between 1974 and more or less the current time in Latin America, obviously in the post-communist states of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union, a little bit in Asia, not too much on average, a fair amount in Africa, and not at all on average in the Middle East. We need to ponder why the Middle East, and particularly the Arab Middle East, stands out as an anomaly in a world that otherwise has experienced quite a remarkable growth of freedom and democracy, and I'll try to do so. I want to begin by eliminating one possibility that would readily come to mind when we're talking about the Middle East, and that is Islam. I believe it's difficult to argue that Islam per se is the problem in terms of the freedom and democracy deficit, particularly in the Arab world. If we separate out from among the 43 states in the world that have a Muslim majority within their borders, those that are members of the Arab League, which are 22 states, from the others that are not, 21, we see that the Arab League member states have a significantly worse freedom score, about 5.5 on the scale, than the non-Arab Muslim majority states, whose average freedom score is about 4.5. Now, let me say, when you only have 7 points on a scale, a full point difference on average is a very large difference. And there's more to it than this. If you think about which Muslim majority states in the world have extensive experience with democracy in the last 30 years or so, you think of South Asia. It may have had a lot of turmoil, but certainly Pakistan has experience, including 11 years between 1988 and 1999, rocky as they were. You think of Bangladesh, which has had a temporary interruption of democracy, but extensive experience with electoral democracy. Indonesia, which is really developing impressively now as an electoral democracy, despite all of the challenges it faces, being spread across such a far-flung archipelago and having to climb out from under the legacy of predatory authoritarian rule under Suharto. You think of Turkey, which is a country that under a sort of Muslim influenced political party, the Justice and Development Party, but a moderate and fairly liberal party in terms of democratic constitutionalism, has really begun to thrive and make a lot of reforms that have oriented it more toward its aspiration for membership in the European Union. And one could point to such African countries as Mali and Senegal, which have a much more democratic experience over the last decade or two. In the Arab world, since the fall of democracy in Lebanon in the mid-1970s, we can't point to a single Arab country that's been a democracy. So there's something going on here again in the Arab Middle East. I will note two problems. One that I will show you later has to do with oil, and the second one has to do with geopolitics. And the geopolitics one is simply that the Arab world sits in a kind of sorry place in terms of democratic incentives and possibilities, where the fog of the Arab-Israeli conflict hangs heavy over the states and societies of the region, where the regimes of the Arab world have been able to use and manipulate this conflict to deflect attention away from their own bad governance and development failures, and to try to focus people's frustrations on the symbolic issues of the Arab-Israeli conflict rather than the actual failings within their own borders of their own systems of government. And where I've just returned from Egypt within the last few weeks, one is quite struck by this, talking to Egyptian liberals, Democrats, businessmen, people in the modern sector. Much of the natural constituency for democracy in these Arab countries of modern sector business people, intellectuals, journalists, professors, either secular people or very liberal, devout Muslims, are scared of radical Islam, scared that in a rapid transition to democracy, in quotation marks, could bring what one former American diplomat quipped would be one person, one vote, one time, after which you'd have the Muslim Brotherhood or some version of it coming to power and shutting down the spirit of democracy. And so many people who would in other societies and historical contexts favor democratization cling to these corrupt, repressive dictatorships as a lesser evil. We need to think about how we can break that stalemate, and I'll come back to that in conclusion. Now, there's another problem, and that is oil. I'll talk about it with you briefly. Before I do, let me just note another positive trend in the world, and that is more and more poor countries have become democracies in this period. It doesn't matter how you draw the line in terms of the level of development of a country as measured by the UN's Human Development Index, which is a better measure of development because it combines and equally weights not only per capita money income, but also levels of education and knowledge and levels of health and well-being as indicated by life expectancy. So if you summarize those into a comprehensive index and look at how countries rank, you find that the bottom two-fifths of the countries in the world are democracies. And there's never been a period in the history of the world where so many less developed countries or even abysmally poor countries meet the standard of electoral democracy. That is, have competitive, multi-party elections with the relatively free media in which people can choose and replace their leaders in free and fair elections. The problem is that in the last 8 years or so, with a certain gathering force we have seen the makings of a democratic recession. One indicator of that is what I've already shared with you, that the progress of democracy in the world has, in a sense, come to a halt over the last decade. It has leveled off at about 3 in every 5 states in the world. But another more telling indicator is that the pace of democratic reversal or breakdown in the world has accelerated. Of the 23 breakdowns of democracy that have occurred during this global wave of democratization in the last 3 decades, 15 of them, that is two-thirds, have occurred just in the last 8 years. And they've come in a number of very strategic states: Pakistan, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, and in 2007, in the assessment of Freedom House, Bangladesh, the Philippines, and Kenya. Some of you may ask the Philippines, what happened in the Philippines? There was no coup, there was no shutting down of parliament. But the Philippines has been seen a long incremental slide in the quality of freedom and democracy, with a kind of threshold being crossed during the re-election effort of its president, Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, in which there's growing evidence of the president having tampered with the electoral process. And, you know, democracy can be lost not only by a military coup or an executive coup, but by a gradual process of strangulation of democratic freedoms and pluralism through the intimidating efforts of an elected president that wants to concentrate power in his or her hands, and through the general loss of efficacy of the democratic process. That has happened gradually over time in Russia, in Venezuela, in Nigeria, and may have happened in the last few years in the Philippines. We also have to note that the last 2 years have been the first 2 successive years since the end of the Cold War in which the number of countries declining in their levels of freedom exceeded the number of countries gaining in their level of freedom. As you can see, since 1991, the typical pattern has been that significantly more countries saw improvements in their levels of freedom than declines. Often the ratio was even twice as many countries. In 1 year, 3 times as many countries in 1998, improving in their average freedom score as declining. But there was a slight unfavorable ratio in 2006 and quite a negative one in 2007. In 2007, Freedom House assessed that 38 countries declined in their average freedom score, and only 10 improved. That's a ratio of almost 4-1 on the negative side, making 2007 the worst year for freedom since the end of the Cold War. Why? Well, there are a number of reasons, but one of them, as Tom Friedman has been talking about for a couple of years now, is the relationship between oil and democracy, not just oil and national security, not just oil and the environment. That oil and democracy really don't mix. I estimate that there are about 23 countries that derive 60% or more of their export earnings from oil and gas. Not a single one of these is a democracy. Why? Well, when you're an oil country that's so dependent on oil and gas for export revenues, at a relatively lower level of development, the money pours into the national treasury and into the control of the state. The state doesn't really effectively tax its citizens in this circumstance because it can depend for its revenue on these external rents. The rents pour in to government coffers, and the government feels responsible to no one for them, certainly not responsible to its own citizens. And as a result, it acts irresponsibly. And there's no organic bond of accountability between the people as taxpayers and the government that has to account for how it's spending the money that it has taken out of the pocketbooks of its citizens. We were founded on the principle of no taxation without representation. But in recent decades, political scientists have, I think quite rightly, come to argue that there's also no meaningful representation without taxation. Without that bond of accountability, incentive for accountability between citizens and their state. And of course, this is one reason why democracy is faring so poorly in the Middle East. If you look at public opinion data, and we're better able to assess the fate of democracy in the world as a result of public opinion data, you find a mixed picture. On the one hand, we can draw inspiration from the fact that in every region of the world in which this question has been asked, do you think democracy is always preferable or that sometimes an authoritarian regime can be preferable, we find majorities of the public saying democracy is always preferable. You might be surprised to know that the average figure in Africa across 18 public opinion surveys done in 2005 was 62%. And it's about 3 in 5 in East Asia and South Asia, a little bit less in Latin America and Eastern Europe. Moreover, people, when they're asked, would you prefer an authoritarian option, military rule, one-party rule, a single person making all the decisions, generally reject these authoritarian options in large numbers by 60, 70, 80% or more. Now, when you aggregate all of this and ask a very robust test of democratic support, to what extent do people reject all authoritarian options put to them, you find a somewhat more wavering public in many countries. In East Asia and Africa, only about half of respondents actively reject all the authoritarian options put to them. Is the glass half full, half empty? You decide, but it's more support, more resilient support, more powerful support for democracy than is often assumed in cultural or civilizational arguments that Africa, Asia, other parts of the world outside the West are not suitable for democracy. That's really not what people in these regions are saying. The problem is people are not only reporting in these surveys what they want, what their aspirations are. They're also making assessments about the performance of democracy in many of their countries. And they're finding it disappointing. And so public support for democracy, as you can see in the Philippines, has declined between 2001 and 2005 from 64 to 51%. There have been sharp declines in the belief that democracy is suitable for the country, the Philippines, in satisfaction with the way democracy works, and in the willingness to reject an authoritarian strong leader. Similarly, you see in Nigeria during a similar period, erosion of public support for democracy, some erosion, though still a very high level of willingness to reject military rule, a collapse of public satisfaction with democracy from 81% in 2000 to 25% in 2005, a similar collapse by two-thirds in levels of trust in the president to only a quarter of the population. And why? Well, one reason why is because you see that the proportion of people who believe that the government is working to control corruption has also badly eroded in this time from 64% to barely one-third. And this leads to me to the third phase of my book and the closing phase of my lecture here, which is about the democratic undertow, the reasons for it, and what we can do about it. Democracy is slipping back in some of the countries where it has been born or struggled to be born because of bad governance. This is the fundamental reason why in some places in the world people are losing faith in democracy and why populist autocrats like Putin in Russia, Chavez in Venezuela, possibly Evo Morales in Bolivia, and others are finding it possible to sweep away democratic norms and institutions, or at a minimum subject them to death by a thousand cuts. And the problems are, first of all, a very weak rule of law, where corruption is rampant, there's extensive abuse of power, abuse of individual rights, where the police are not strong enough, the Justice Department is not effective and independent enough to protect people's rights and freedoms and to control corruption. I cannot underscore to you enough how much widespread corruption and predatory self-seeking on the part of government officials disillusions people about the formal institutions of democracy and drives them into the arms of populist autocrats who offer specious promises of cleaner, more responsive government. They don't deliver on it, but they offer the illusion of it. Secondly, many people are being disillusioned by bad economic performance, and particularly in countries like Bolivia and Venezuela, but also Russia after the collapse of communism, where there's so much poverty or decline in personal income and massive inequality, which is the story of Latin America historically, and social injustice and degradation of the poor, so many people living, 40% or more in some Latin American countries on less than $2 a day, or in extreme poverty on less than a dollar a day. And people are willing to be patient. In fact, we see that people in poor countries have been more patient in the post-communist world, in Africa and Latin America, than we could have imagined. But they're not going to be patient forever. They do expect at least incremental progress in terms of democracy delivering gradually a better life. We see as well other problems with democracy's performance in terms of its failure to manage ethnic and religious divisions, in terms of weak and ineffective political institutions that are not able to reform bad governance, reduce corruption, and be responsive to public interests. Parties are weak. Parliaments are co-opted, may barely meet. Parliamentary committees have no resources. Systems of horizontal accountability, both the judiciary but also independent counter-corruption commissions, audit agencies, even the Electoral Commission, are independent only in name, often captured by the ruling party, and serve at the pleasure of the president. As a result of the structure of the state, of the weakness and pressure on civil society and the mass media, and the lack of will on the part of actors in the international community, there are weak constraints on bad rulers. Bad rulers in authoritarian regimes, whether they're soft authoritarian or the tragedy of a country like Zimbabwe or Burma, and weak constraints even on formerly democratic regimes that don't live up to the promise of their constitution, to the spirit of democracy, and within the context of barely free and fair and competitive elections, relentlessly abuse power once it's acquired through that process. Now, my argument in conclusion is that if the democratic recession is going to be reversed in the world and democratic progress is going to be renewed, it has to begin by strengthening, improving the quality of, and consolidating the dozens of new democracies in the world that have come into being in this period, many of which are really very weak in their structures and performance. And the central goal here must be to foster and build patterns and institutions of good governance. In some cases, this means stronger states, not necessarily larger states, but stronger in terms of capacity, professionalism, resources, training, coherence, and yes, if I may say this, coming from an institution that is associated with the religion of lower taxes always being a general public good, the ability of the state to tax and mobilize resources for the public welfare. You know, in Latin America, the state collects, in some cases, 8, 10, 12, 14% of gross national product in taxation. You can't do very much to educate people, to reduce poverty, to inoculate children, to deliver public infrastructure, to enable broad-based economic development when the state is taxing so little. That might sound very good to a libertarian, but in fact, it just doesn't facilitate just development. It doesn't have to be 40 or 50%, but it certainly has to be, you know, significantly more mobilization of public resources for public ends. And then once taxes are collected, they must be used for public ends. And that means mobilizing a spirit of commitment to the public good that cannot happen without stronger, more vigorous institutions to control corruption and enforce a rule of law. This means real independent institutions of corruption control, auditing of public accounts, and an independent judiciary. And it requires a strong civil society, not only to elicit public participation and debate, but to have the kind of free and independent media that can be another line of defense against bad government. This requires, as well, the accumulation of social capital, the ability of citizens to cooperate for public ends, and the scrutiny of government performance in civil society. Let me conclude by saying that I think there's a lot that we need to do in order to cultivate democratic progress in the world and renew the spirit of democracy so that we can end the global democratic recession and resume the at least gradual progress of democracy and freedom in the world. But I'd like to highlight three things. Number one, if you follow the logic of what I said, that, you know, states have to be responsible for the resources they get, and external rents like oil revenue that just flow into government coffers are corrosive of commitment to the public good and very enabling of bad governance, then it should logically follow that when you dump foreign aid unconditionally into the lap of a bad, abusive, unaccountable government, what you're going to get is a more resourceful, bad, unaccountable, abusive government. And not development, and not improvement of public welfare. So aid in much of the world, in the unconditional terms that it has flowed over the last several decades, has too often, not always, but too often functioned like oil. Just another source of external rents that can be, and often very unjustly is, captured by ruling elites for their benefit, their bank accounts, their palatial residences in their own countries and abroad, rather than for the benefit of the people. We need very radical, fundamental, far-reaching reform of the whole logic of development assistance in the world, so it really becomes development assistance. Second of all, we've had emerged during this period of global democratization a whole new set of exchanges, forms of aid, partnerships to assist democratic development in many of these countries and to help improve governance in many of these countries. It happens through a new form of organization, the quasi-non-governmental organization of publicly funded democracy assistance organizations like the National Endowment for Democracy in the United States, the Westminster Foundation in Britain, the Netherlands Institute for Multi-Party Democracy. The European Union is in the process of forming a democracy promotion organization collaboratively. Canada is debating one as well. The development assistance organizations of these states have gotten more and more into the business of aiding democratic development and good governance development around the world. The UN Development Program is also more and more involved in this. That has to be continued and, I believe, accelerated. And finally, I think it's not untimely to say this as we're winding down, hopefully, to the conclusion of a long and interesting primary season in the American presidential election. We need to pay attention to and invest our resources and moral and intellectual energy in the sorry state of our own democracy in the United States. We cannot be effective in promoting democracy around the world. We cannot have the moral authority to defend infringements of democracy elsewhere in the world and lobby for freedom and human rights when we don't respect it ourselves in our international behavior and when our own democratic institutions and practices are fraying in as many ways as they are in the United States. We need to sign the International Convention Against Torture. We need to renounce the use of it. We need to close down Guantanamo. We need a presidential directive that forever forbids any American official at any level in any way from using torture and recognizing it for what it is and not playing word games about it. We need to respect the rule of law in terms of the relations between branches of government. We need to rethink the way that congressional and state legislative districts are drawn in the United States. So the scandal, really it is a scandal, of gross gerrymandering of legislative districts to protect incumbents and really frustrate the spirit of democracy in the United States can be reformed. That spirit of reform has to be brought more vigorously to bear on the lobbying process, and, well, I could go on and on, but I don't need to because I do it in the last chapter of my book. Thank you very much. So I hope you will have some questions and comments now that I can address.
Would you revisit the Middle East? Basically, the way I see it from what people are saying is we do not want them to have democracy because it is not in our interest whatsoever. We help them have elections, they'll elect the extremists, and that's the end of it. So we're better off with no democracy in the Middle East.
Yeah, I'd say that's a bit of a caricature, but probably not too much. You know, after September 11th, President Bush and many people in his administration, my former colleague Condoleezza Rice and others, appeared to be convinced that, as President Bush declared on the 20th anniversary of the creation of the National Endowment for Democracy, November 6th, 2003, in a speech to NED, that 60 years of American policy, I'm paraphrasing only slightly, supporting stability at the expense of freedom brought us neither freedom nor stability. And so he announced on that day a new forward strategy for freedom in the Middle East. And people in the region were euphoric in response to it. And then what happened, as you've noted. We got elections in Palestine, Hamas won. We got elections in Lebanon, Hezbollah did very well. We got elections in Iraq, and between the Shiite Islamists and the Sunni Islamists, the Islamists, you know, got a majority of all the votes cast. And we got elections in Egypt, and in the first two rounds of the Egyptian parliamentary elections, 88 members of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is half of all the Muslim Brotherhood candidates running in the election, won 20% of the seats in parliament. And then the Bush administration by the end of that horrible year for, quote, democracy, end quote, in the Middle East of 2005, had largely the reaction you described. They thought, oh my God, democracy means the Islamists are going to win, so we better back off from it. And they just walked away from it, really walked away from it. And people in the region became extremely bitter and felt betrayed. Now, this was really a bungling of the approach that should have been taken and has landed us in the worst of all possible worlds. On the one hand, we have given democracy, quote unquote, something of a bad name in the region by having pushed it in the way we did in Iraq through the use of force. So democracy promotion in the region now is now seen as America imposing it by use of force. And on the other hand, we've sent the message that if we don't like the results of a competitive political process, we'll just walk away from it. So authoritarian leaders feel like they have a new lease on life, that the pressure is off. Mubarak feels once again very comfortable enough to still be holding his presidential election opponent, someone who basically shares our values of a secular and liberal democracy, Ayman Nour, in prison. What are we doing? Egypt is getting over $1 billion in aid from the United States, and Mubarak's presidential election opponent is sitting on totally ridiculous and trumped-up charges in prison. And this after President Bush said in his second inaugural address these words, which, by the way, were heard and heeded in the Middle East. When you stand up for freedom, we will stand with you. I wonder what Ayman Nour thinks about those words as he sits in ill health in his prison cell in Egypt. We have very little moral credibility in the Middle East now as a result of this hypocrisy. And I think what we needed then and need now is a new policy that's resolute on the one hand and honest on the other. The resoluteness has to be in being willing to stay the course in the search for freedom and just government in the Middle East. The honesty has to be in recognizing that they're not going to get there overnight, that right now there is a bifurcated playing field in most Arab states. There's the regime of Mubarak, King Abdullah in Jordan, you pick your Arab autocrat, on the one hand, and there is the Islamists on the other hand, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, the Islamic Action Front in Jordan, whatever it might be. There's a more complicated landscape in some states, in Lebanon to be sure, in Morocco, where the Islamists actually did not do well in the recent election, and where, you know, it's one of the two or three Arab countries that's most ready for a true democratic opening. But elsewhere, even the Democrats are saying, and said to me in Cairo last month, we are only asking for a gradual opening to democracy. We're not asking for democracy tomorrow. We don't even want democracy tomorrow because we need time to create a third alternative between the regime and the Islamists. Political parties that might be secular, that might be very moderately Islamist in orientation, looking to the model of the Justice and Development Party in Turkey, but they then need time to establish their platforms, to build their constituencies, to recruit followings, to raise money, to win elections at the local level and show that they can exercise power. And maybe during that period of gradual democratization, some of the more radical Islamists today might traverse the path of evolution that the political Islamists in Turkey have traversed, that have led to the moderation of the Justice and Development Party in Turkey. But the point is, there's no such evolution underway. And in Egypt today, the Wasat Party, which is a moderate Islamist party, is banned. And most of the secular democratic parties are either banned or they're allowed to run, and then their candidates are imprisoned after the election.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. The microphone. Yeah, speak into the mic.
Do you think the Iraqi present leadership can stay in power? Do you think it can solve some of its problems? I know Condoleezza Rice had gone to Iraq. She thought they were now fighting some of their militia.
Yeah.
Is there any chance for survival?
The problem in Iraq is that the leadership is very fragmented, and there's no consensus on the basic constitutional structure of the country. And I think before we can look for better governance and more progress toward a reduction in violence in Iraq, we need not only the military surge that's happened, but a political or diplomatic surge to try and broker a more substantial consensus on the major constitutional issues that still divide, in particular, the Sunnis from the Shia and Kurds. And this has to address unresolved issues in Iraq's federal system, in the structure of presidential government, the sharing of the oil revenue, who controls the oil in the country. None of this has been solved. And the Bush administration, for reasons that escape me, has had a very, relaxed and cavalier attitude toward this constitutional stalemate. So I think this has to become a much higher priority. And if it doesn't, and we don't get more constitutional compromise, I think we're going to drift through more and more incoherent, ineffective government in Baghdad and, risk seeing a much sharper escalation of the violence in the months to come. There and there. Yeah.
Do you think that a change in our administration here will make a difference in the Baghdad government, say if Obama were elected?
Well, I never use a forum like this to make a partisan statement. So all I can say is that, what is obvious, Senator McCain has largely supported President Bush's position. He was a strong advocate of the surge. The surge made some military progress, as I believed it would. When I was in Iraq in the first 3 months of 2004, I was pleading for the administration to send more troops. And I wrote my former colleague, Condoleezza Rice, I thought made a very strong case about why more needed to be done on the military side. But that I made clear then, and I think has been apparent throughout, is only part of the problem. I have not heard Senator McCain talk about the other side of the problem, which is the need for a political and diplomatic breakthrough on this constitutional impasse and the need to exert leverage on the different Iraqi parties to be responsible, both in their handling of the now $60 billion that they may be getting this year in oil revenue, and in their handling of the big political questions that still divide them from one another. In the case of Senator Obama, I think he's probably much more sensitive to the need for a diplomatic surge. On the other hand, if we're going to withdraw unconditionally by a fixed timetable and pace, irrespective of what happens on the ground, then we lose in a different way leverage that might be applied on the Iraqi parties. I predict he will find, if he is elected and becomes president, that the situation will not simply permit a fixed, unyielding timetable disconnected from events in Iraq, that the pace and timing of American military withdrawal will have to be more interactive with events on the ground in Iraq. It needs to be communicated that we're headed in that direction, but it may not simply be that most American combat troops are out by the end of 2009. I think, in fact, that's going to be very difficult for any president to achieve.
I've traveled to many of the countries that you listed, and I've lived in a few of them. And from my experience, notwithstanding all the failures and misgivings of our efforts in promoting democracy, there really isn't any other country in the world or the UN doing as much as America. Would you agree with that?
To promote democracy?
Yes.
Abroad?
Yes.
Yes, I would unequivocally agree with that. But I would say a couple of things. Number one, that effort is not enough. We need to be effective. So it's not just a question of how much we spend, it's how intelligently we spend it. And, of course, when you're looking at the overall development assistance effort, the United States is a real laggard in terms of the percentage of our gross national product that we give in foreign aid. We're, you know, like 21 out of 23 aid-giving countries in the world. We're way behind. Now, you know, as a result of that, Senator Obama has called for a doubling of American foreign aid. I, as you can infer from what I have said, am not opposed to such a dramatic increase in American foreign aid under any circumstance, but I am opposed to it without very clear conditions about what countries need to do to qualify for the aid. That is, that they need to show that they're serious about controlling corruption, building a rule of law, and delivering good government. We do more to assist the development not only of democratic elections, political parties, and civil society, but also good government in many respects, than I'd say probably any other country in the world. But we can't be effective in this if we're doing it unilaterally. I think it needs closer coordination with our allies. So does the effort to demand accountability in aid, to tie it to conditions of performance. That's not going to work unless it's multilateral. That's one reason, among many, why the Millennium Challenge Account has not had, which is a new performance-based vehicle of foreign aid, has not had the impact it might have. But there's two more things I want to say, which I think will echo what I've said over the last hour. One is that, even in the sort of political realm of pressing for democracy, we've been too unilateral and too moralistic, and I think often our efforts have backfired. And the world, particularly in an era of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, is just sick of hearing moralistic language from the U.S. about human rights and democracy. So we have to be more modest. We have to be more multilateral. And we have to be more self-reflective if we're going to be effective. And the second thing is we just have to be consistent. We can't say democracy is good for this part of the world but not for that part of the world. Or we want democracy and free elections now, but then when we don't like the results, we simply shut up and embrace the dictator who has destroyed the process. What respect are we going to have for our word and our purpose when we behave like that?
Well, you just answered my follow-up question. I don't think we can keep going in the same direction we are now.
Yeah, so we ought to think about how this can be more sustainable. My answer is not that we then stop promoting democracy, but we have to do so in ways that are more incremental, more tied to real conditions in the world, and more sustainable.
Time for one more question.
Is it true, or do you believe that...
Just speak into the microphone,
yeah,
it will be better.
Do you believe that a necessary condition for democracy or a liberal democracy is sound economic system? And conversely, can a dictatorship exist if there's economic prosperity across a country?
Those are good questions. I'll take the second one first. The only really wealthy industrialized country that is, with high levels of development on the Human Development Index, the only one of the top 25 on the Human Development Index that's not a democracy today is Singapore. And so can it exist? Well, in principle, yes. Look at Singapore. But I don't think Singapore's authoritarian regime is going to last. I address this in my book. And I think that as there's generational change in the leadership of Singapore, with the extraordinary founding leader, but a very domineering and autocratic one, Lee Kuan Yew, passing from the scene, a new generation of young Singaporeans rising up. You know, the survey data shows they're going to want more participation, more freedom, more voice. They're going to get tired of being treated like children, which is the way they're treated by their political leaders. So I think that over time, it will be anomalous to have wealthy, industrialized, high-knowledge-intensive non-democracies. Now, at the other end of the spectrum, we know that democracy can emerge in the absence of economic development or a sound economy. The question is, can it be sustained without that? And I would say the evidence shows that poor countries can become democracies, but that the quality of democracy will improve under the formal institutions of democracy as economic development proceeds, as people become more knowledgeable, better educated, have more resources, there's more dispersion of economic power, the rise of capitalism, if you will. By the same token, the evidence shows that poor countries can sustain democracy, but it's much harder for them to do so in the absence of economic development. That the worst combination for democratic stability is poverty plus economic stagnation. So if poor countries like the ones I've talked about here are going to sustain democracy, and then gradually deepen it, they do need sustained, broadly based economic development.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Diamond for his interesting discussion. I'd also like to thank all of you for coming and for our audience on the recorded versions of this. And this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.